In 1950, the Korean War broke out, and that was a depressing time indeed, almost as depressing as the present. I will not conceal from you that I am not enthusiastic over what Othello called the quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. World War II had been something unique. That was one war there could be few idealistic qualms over. We were fighting an absolute evil that seemed quite beyond the usual defame-the-enemy routine. And there seemed a reasonable hope that once the war was over, there would be some way of setting up a form of world organization to prevent future wars. The euphoria of the days of the immediate end of the war and of the setting up of the United Nations didn't last long, and the Korean War spelled final ruin to the first great hopes. You might think that we science fiction writers were luckier than most. We had so nice a way of escaping. Off we could go into space, leaving the earthbound problems of the day behind us. Well, escape isn't that easy. It is harder than you think to divorce yourself from reality, and when, in the days of Korea, I blasted off in my spaceship for the empty distances between the stars, what did I find? An interstellar war. A battle for a spaceship. I wasn't escaping at all. But one more thing. Before the days of television, there was something called radio. And in the late 1940s and early 1950s, we had science fiction on it. Radio didn't have the problem of the complicated and expensive sets that television requires in order to give a semblance of reality to science fiction. It can do everything with sound effects, and the proper sounds can be made into the most bizarre visual effects in the mind. The programs involved, 2000 Plus and Dimension X, were unfortunately not heavily sponsored when they were sponsored at all, and they did not last long. But while they were on, they were intensely satisfying to me. What's more, they ran no less than three of my stories. One of them was Nightfall, of course, and a second was Sea Shoot. In the radio version of Sea Shoot, Mullen was played by an actor with a distinctive voice, dry, restrained, unemotional, and gentle. It was exactly Mullen's voice. Once television came in, I found that voice and matched the face to it, and that looked like Mullen. It is so pleasant every time I see him to be able to say, despite the fact that he is a fairly tall man, "There's Mullen." Mullen is the only one of all my characters I have seen in the flesh, and I have carefully refrained from ever finding out the actor's real name. I want him to remain Mullen. First appearance, Galaxy Science Fiction, October 1951, copyright 1951 by Galaxy Publishing Corporation. Sea Shoot. Even from the cabin into which he and the other passengers had been herded, Colonel Anthony Wyndham could still catch the essence of the battle's progress. For a while, there was silence, no jolting, which meant the spaceships were fighting at astronomical distance in a duel of energy blasts and powerful force field defenses. He knew that could have only one end. Their Earth ship was only an armed merchantman, and his glimpse of the Chloro enemy just before he had been cleared off deck by the crew was sufficient to show it to be a light cruiser. And in less than half an hour, there came those hard little shocks he was waiting for. The passengers swayed back and forth as the ship pitched and veered, as though it were an ocean liner in a storm. But space was calm and silent as ever. It was their pilot sending desperate bursts of steam through the steam tubes, so that by reaction the ship would be sent rolling and tumbling. It could only mean that the inevitable had occurred. The Earth ship's screens had been drained, and it no longer dared withstand a direct hit. Colonel Wyndham tried to steady himself with his aluminum cane. He was thinking that he was an old man, that he had spent his life in the militia and had never seen a battle. That now, with a battle going on around him, he was old and fat and lame and had no men under his command. They would be boarding soon, those Chloro monsters. It was their way of fighting. They would be handicapped by spacesuits, and their casualties would be high, but they wanted the Earth ship. Wyndham considered the passengers. For a moment, he thought, if they were armed, and I could lead them. He abandoned the thought, Porter was in an obvious state of funk, and the young boy LeBlanc was hardly better. The Polyorchides brothers, dash it, he couldn't tell them apart, huddled in a corner, speaking only to one another. Mullen was a different matter. He sat perfectly erect, with no signs of fear or any other emotion in his face. But the man was just about 5 feet tall, and had undoubtedly never held a gun of any sort in his hands in all his life. He could do nothing. And there was Stuart, with his frozen half-smile and the high-pitched sarcasm which saturated all he said. Wyndham looked sidelong at Stuart, now as Stuart sat there, pushing his dead-white hands through his sandy hair. With those artificial hands, he was useless anyway. Wyndham felt the shuddering vibration of ship-to-ship contact, and in 5 minutes there was the noise of the fight through the corridors. One of the Polyorchides brothers screamed and dashed for the door. The other called, "Aristides, wait!" and hurried after. It happened so quickly. Aristides was out the door and into the corridor, running in brainless panic. A carbonizer glowed briefly, and there was never even a scream. Wyndham, from the doorway, turned in horror at the blackened stump of what was left. Strange. A lifetime in uniform, and he had never before seen a man killed in violence. It took the combined force of the rest to carry the other brother back, struggling into the room. The noise of battle subsided. Stuart said, "That's it. They'll put a prize crew of two aboard and take us to one of their home planets. We're prisoners of war, naturally." "Only two of the Chloros will stay aboard?" asked Wyndham, astonished. Stuart said, "It is their custom. Why do you ask, Colonel? Thinking of leading a gallant raid to retake the ship?" Wyndham flushed. "Simply a point of information, dash it." But the dignity and tone of authority he tried to assume failed him, he knew. He was simply an old man with a limp. And Stuart was probably right. He had lived among the Chloros and knew their ways. John Stuart had claimed from the beginning that the Chloros were gentlemen. 24 hours of imprisonment had passed, and now he repeated the statement as he flexed the fingers of his hands and watched the crinkles come and go in the soft artoplasm. He enjoyed the unpleasant reaction it aroused in the others. People were made to be punctured, windy bladders, all of them, and they had hands of the same stuff as their bodies. There was Anthony Wyndham in particular, Colonel Wyndham, he called himself, and Stuart was willing to believe it, a retired colonel who had probably drilled a home guard militia on a village green 40 years ago with such lack of distinction that he was not called back to service in any capacity, even during the emergency of Earth's first interstellar war.
"Dashed unpleasant thing to be saying about the enemy, Stuart. Don't know that I like your attitude."
Wyndham seemed to push the words through his clipped mustache. His head had been shaven, too, in imitation of the current military style, but now a gray stubble was beginning to show about a centered bald patch. His flabby cheeks dragged downward. That and the fine red lines on his thick nose gave him a somewhat undone appearance, as though he had been wakened too suddenly and too early in the morning. Stuart said,
"Nonsense. Just reverse the present situation. Suppose an Earth warship had taken a Chloro liner. What do you think would have happened to any Chloro civilians aboard?"
"I'm sure the Earth fleet would observe all the interstellar rules of war," Wyndham said stiffly.
"Except that there aren't any. If we landed a prize crew on one of their ships, do you think we'd take the trouble to maintain a chlorine atmosphere for the benefit of the survivors? Allow them to keep their non-contraband possessions? Give them the use of the most comfortable stateroom, etc., etc., etc.?"
Ben Porter said, "Oh, shut up, for God's sake. If I hear your etc., etc. once again, I'll go nuts." Stuart said, "Sorry." He wasn't. Porter was scarcely responsible. His thin face and beaky nose glistened with perspiration, and he kept biting the inside of his cheek until he suddenly winced. He put his tongue against the sore spot, which made him look even more clownish. Stuart was growing weary of baiting them. Wyndham was too flabby a target, and Porter could do nothing but writhe. The rest were silent. Demetrius Polyorchides was off in a world of silent internal grief for the moment. He had not slept the night before, most probably. At least, whenever Stuart woke to change his position, he himself had been rather restless. There had been Polyorcetes' thick mumble from the next cot. It said many things, but the moan to which it returned over and over again was, "Oh, my brother." He sat dumbly on his cot now, his red eyes rolling at the other prisoners out of his broad, swarthy, unshaven face. As Stuart watched, his face sank into calloused palms so that only his mop of crisp and curly black hair could be seen. He rocked gently, but now that they were all awake, he made no sound. Claude LeBlanc was trying very unsuccessfully to read a letter. He was the youngest of the six, scarcely out of college, returning to Earth to get married. Stuart had found him that morning weeping quietly, his pink and white face flushed and blotched as though it were a heartbroken child's. He was very fair, with almost a girl's beauty about his large blue eyes and full lips. Stuart wondered what kind of girl it was who had promised to be his wife. He had seen her picture, who on the ship had not. She had the characterless prettiness that makes all pictures of fiancés indistinguishable. It seemed to Stuart that if he were a girl, however, he would want someone a little more pronouncedly masculine. That left only Randolph Mullen. Stuart frankly did not have the least idea what to make of him. He was the only one of the six that had been on the Arcturian worlds for any length of time. Stuart himself, for instance, had been there only long enough to give a series of lectures on astronautical engineering at the Provincial Engineering Institute. Colonel Wyndham had been on a cook's tour. Porter was trying to buy concentrated alien vegetables for his canneries on Earth. And the Polyorcetes brothers had attempted to establish themselves in Arcturus as truck farmers and, after two growing seasons, gave it up, had somehow unloaded at a profit, and were returning to Earth. Randolph Mullen, however, had been in the Arcturian system for 17 years. How did voyagers discover so much about one another so quickly? As far as Stuart knew, the little man had scarcely spoken aboard ship. He was unfailingly polite, always stepped to one side to allow another to pass, but his entire vocabulary appeared to consist only of "thank you" and "pardon me." Yet the word had gone around that this was his first trip to Earth in 17 years. He was a little man, very precise, almost irritatingly so. Upon awaking that morning, he had made his cot neatly, shaved, bathed, and dressed. A habit of years seemed not in the least disturbed by the fact that he was a prisoner of the Chloros now. He was unobtrusive about it, it had to be admitted, and gave no impression of disapproving of the sloppiness of the others. He simply sat there, almost apologetic, trussed in his over-conservative clothing, and hands loosely clasped in his lap. The thin line of hair on his upper lip, far from adding character to his face, absurdly increased its primness. He looked like someone's idea of a caricature of a bookkeeper, and the queer thing about it all, Stuart thought, was that that was exactly what he was. He had noticed it on the registry. Randolph Llewellyn Mullen, occupation, bookkeeper, employers, Prime Paper Box Company, 27 Tobias Avenue, New Warsaw, Arcturus 2. "Mr. Stuart?" Stuart looked up. It was LeBlanc, his lower lip trembling slightly. Stuart tried to remember how one went about being gentle. He said, "What is it, LeBlanc? Tell me, when will they let us go?" "How should I know? Everyone says you lived on a Chloro planet, and just now you said they were gentlemen." "Well, yes. But even gentlemen fight wars in order to win. Probably will be interned for the duration."
"But that could be years. Margaret is waiting. She'll think I'm dead."
"I suppose they'll allow messages to be sent through once we're on their planet." Porter's hoarse voice sounded in agitation.
"Look here. If you know so much about these devils, what will they do to us while we're interned? What will they feed us? Where will they get oxygen for us? They'll kill us, I tell you. And as an afterthought, I've got a wife waiting for me, too," he added.
But Stuart had heard him speaking of his wife in the days before the attack. He wasn't impressed. Porter's nail-bitten fingers were pulling and plucking at Stuart's sleeve. Stuart drew away in sharp revulsion. He couldn't stand those ugly hands. It angered him to desperation that such monstrosities should be real, while his own white and perfectly shaped hands were only mocking imitations grown out of an alien latex. He said, "They won't kill us. If they were going to, they would have done it before now. Look, we capture Chloros too, you know, and it's just a matter of common sense to treat your prisoners decently if you want the other side to be decent to your men. They'll do their best. The food may not be very good, but they're better chemists than we are. It's what they're best at. They'll know exactly what food factors we'll need and how many calories. We'll live. They'll see to that."
Wyndham rumbled, "You sound more and more like a blasted greenie sympathizer, Stuart. It turns my stomach to hear an Earthman speak well of the green fellows the way you've been doing. Burn it, man. Where's your loyalty?"
"My loyalty's where it belongs, with honesty and decency, regardless of the shape of the being it appears in." Stuart held up his hands. "See these? Chloros made them. I lived on one of their planets for 6 months. My hands were mangled in the conditioning machinery of my own quarters. I thought the oxygen supply they gave me was a little poor. It wasn't, by the way. And I tried making the adjustments on my own. It was my fault. You should never trust yourself with the machines of another culture. By the time someone among the Chloros could put on an atmosphere suit and get to me, it was too late to save my hands. They grew these artiplasm things for me and operated. You know what that meant? It meant designing equipment and nutrient solutions that would work in oxygen atmosphere. It meant that their surgeons had to perform a delicate operation while dressed in atmosphere suits. And now I've got hands again." He laughed harshly and clenched them into weak fists. "Hands," Wyndham said.
"And you'd sell your loyalty to Earth for that?"
"Sell my loyalty? You're mad. For years I hated the Chloros for this. I was a master pilot on the transgalactic space lines before it happened. Now, desk job. Or an occasional lecture. It took me a long time to pin the fault on myself and to realize that the only role played by the Chloros was a decent one. They have their code of ethics, and it's as good as ours. If it weren't for the stupidity of some of their people, and by God, of some of ours, we wouldn't be at war, and after it's over..." Polyorcetes was on his feet. His thick fingers curved inward before him, and his dark eyes glittered.
"I don't like what you say, mister."
"Why don't you?"
"Because you talk too nice about these damned green bastards. The Chloros were good to you, eh? Well, they weren't good to my brother. They killed him. I think maybe I kill you, you damned greeny spy."
And he charged. Stuart barely had time to raise his arms to meet the infuriated farmer. He gasped out, "What the hell?" as he caught one wrist and heaved a shoulder to block the other, which groped toward his throat. His artiplasm hand gave way. Polyorcetes wrenched free with scarcely an effort. Wyndham was bellowing incoherently, and LeBlanc was calling out in his reedy voice, "Stop it! Stop it!" But it was little Mullen who threw his arms about the farmer's neck from behind and pulled with all his might. He was not very effective. Polyorcetes seemed scarcely aware of the little man's weight upon his back. Mullen's feet left the floor so that he tossed helplessly to right and left, but he held his grip, and it hampered Polyorcetes sufficiently to allow Stuart to break free long enough to grasp Wyndham's aluminum cane. He said, "Stay away, Polyorcetes!" He was gasping for breath and fearful of another rush. The hollow aluminum cylinder was scarcely heavy enough to accomplish much, but it was better than having only his weak hands to defend himself with. Mullen had loosed his hold and was now circling cautiously, his breathing roughened and his jacket in disarray. Polyorcetes, for a moment, did not move. He stood there, his shaggy head bent low. Then he said,
"It is no use. I must kill Chloros. Just watch your tongue, Stuart.
If it keeps on rattling too much, you're liable to get hurt. Really hurt, I mean." Stuart passed a forearm over his forehead and thrust the cane back at Wyndham, who seized it with his left hand while mopping his bald pate vigorously with a handkerchief in his right. Wyndham said,
"Gentlemen, we must avoid this. It lowers our prestige. We must remember the common enemy. We are Earthmen, and we must act what we are, the ruling race of the galaxy. We dare not demean ourselves before the lesser breeds."
"Yes, Colonel," said Stuart wearily. "Give us the rest of the speech tomorrow." He turned to Mullen. "I want to say thanks." He was uncomfortable about it, but he had to. The little accountant had surprised him completely, but Mullen said in a dry voice that scarcely raised above a whisper,
"Don't thank me, Mr. Stewart. It was the logical thing to do. If we are to be interned, we would need you as an interpreter, perhaps one who would understand the chloros."
Stewart stiffened. It was, he thought, too much of the bookkeeper type of reasoning, too logical, too dry of juice. Present risk and ultimate advantage. The assets and debits balanced neatly. He would have liked Mullen to leap to his defense out of... well, out of what? Out of pure, unselfish decency?
Stewart laughed silently at himself. He was beginning to expect idealism of human beings rather than good, straightforward, self-centered motivation.
Polyarchides was numb. His sorrow and rage were like acid inside him, but they had no words to get out. If he were Stewart, big mouth, white hands Stewart, he could talk and talk and maybe feel better. Instead, he had to sit there with half of him dead, with no brother, no Aristides. It had happened so quickly. If he could only go back and have 1 second more warning so that he might snatch Aristides, hold him, save him. But mostly, he hated the chloros. 2 months ago, he had hardly ever heard of them, and now he hated them so hard, he would be glad to die if he could kill a few. He said without looking up, "What happened to start this war, eh?" He was afraid Stewart's voice would answer. He hated Stewart's voice, but it was Wyndham, the bald one. Wyndham said, "The immediate cause, sir, was a dispute over mining concessions in the Wyandot system. The chloros had poached unearthed property."
"Room for both, Colonel."
Polyarchides looked up at that, snarling. Stewart could not be kept quiet for long. He was speaking again, the cripple hand wise guy chloros lover. Stewart was saying, "Is that anything to fight over, Colonel? We can't use one another's worlds. Their chlorine planets are useless to us, and our oxygen ones are useless to them. Chlorine is deadly to us, and oxygen is deadly to them. There's no way we could maintain permanent hostility. Our races just don't coincide. Is there reason to fight, then, because both races want to dig iron out of the same airless planetoids when there are millions like them in the galaxy?"
Wyndham said, "There is the question of planetary honor."
"Planetary fertilizer? How can it excuse a ridiculous war like this one? It can only be fought on outposts. It has to come down to a series of holding actions and eventually be settled by negotiations that might just as easily have been worked out in the first place. Neither we nor the chloros will gain a thing."
Grudgingly, Polyarchides found that he agreed with Stewart. What did he and Aristides care where Earth or the chloros got their iron? Was that something for Aristides to die over? The little warning buzzer sounded. Polyarchides' head shot up, and he rose slowly, his lips drawing back. Only one thing could be at the door. He waited, arms tense, fists balled. Stewart was edging toward him. Polyarchides saw that and laughed to himself. Let the chloro come in, and Stewart, along with all the rest, could not stop him. "Wait, Aristides. Wait just a moment, and a fraction of revenge will be paid back." The door opened, and a figure entered, completely swathed in a shapeless, billowing travesty of a spacesuit. An odd, unnatural, but not entirely unpleasant voice began, "It is with some misgivings, Earthmen, that my companion and myself..." It ended abruptly, as Polyarchides, with a roar, charged once again. There was no science in the lunge. It was sheer bull momentum. Dark head, low, burly arms spread out, with the hair-tufted fingers in choking position. He clumped on. Stewart was whirled to one side before he had a chance to intervene, and was spun tumbling across a cot. The chloro might have, without undue exertion, straight-armed Polyarchides to a halt, or stepped aside, allowing the whirlwind to pass. He did neither. With a rapid movement, a hand weapon was up, and a gentle pinkish line of radiance connected it with the plunging Earthman.
Polyorcetes stumbled and crashed down, his body maintaining its last curved position, one foot raised as though a lightning paralysis had taken place. It toppled to one side, and he lay there, eyes all alive and wild with rage. The Chloro said,
"He is not permanently hurt."
He seemed not to resent the offered violence. Then he began again.
"It is with some misgiving, Earthmen, that my companion and myself were made aware of a certain commotion in this room. Are you in any need which we can satisfy?"
Stuart was angrily nursing his knee, which he had scraped in colliding with the cot. He said, "No, thank you, Chloro."
"Now look here," puffed Wyndham. "This is a dashed outrage. We demand that our release be arranged."
The Chloro's tiny, insect-like head turned in the fat old man's direction. He was not a pleasant sight to anyone unused to him. He was about the height of an Earthman, but the top of him consisted of a thin stalk of a neck with a head that was the merest swelling. It consisted of a blunt, triangular proboscis in front and two bulging eyes on either side. That was all. There was no brain pan and no brain. What corresponded to the brain in a Chloro was located in what would be an earthly abdomen, leaving the head as a mere sensory organ. The Chloro's spacesuit followed the outlines of the head more or less faithfully, the two eyes being exposed by two clear semicircles of glass which looked faintly green because of the chlorine atmosphere inside. One of the eyes was now cocked squarely at Wyndham, who quivered uncomfortably under the glance, but insisted,
"You have no right to hold us prisoner. We are non-combatants."
The Chloro's voice, sounding thoroughly artificial, came from a small attachment of chromium mesh on what served as its chest. The voice box was manipulated by compressed air under the control of one or two of the many delicate forked tendrils that radiated from two circles about its upper body and were mercifully enough hidden by the suit. The voice said,
"Are you serious, Earthman? Surely you have heard of war and rules of war and prisoners of war?"
It looked about, shifting eyes with quick jerks of its head, staring at a particular object first with one, then with another. It was Stuart's understanding that each eye transferred a separate message to the abdominal brain, which had to coordinate the two to obtain full information. Wyndham had nothing to say. No one had. The Chloro, its four main limbs, roughly arms and legs in pairs, had a vaguely human appearance under the masking of the suit, if you looked no higher than its chest, but there was no way of telling what it felt. They watched it turn and leave. Porter coughed and said in a strangled voice, "God, smell that chlorine. If they don't do something, we'll all die of rotted lungs." Stuart said, "Shut up. There isn't enough chlorine in the air to make a mosquito sneeze. And what there is will be swept out in 2 minutes. Besides, a little chlorine is good for you. It may kill your cold virus." Wyndham coughed and said,
"Stuart, I feel that you might have said something to your Chloro friend about releasing us. You are scarcely as bold in their presence, Deschet, as you are once they are gone."
"You heard what the creature said, Colonel. We're prisoners of war, and prisoner exchanges are negotiated by diplomats. We'll just have to wait."
The blank, who had turned pasty white at the entrance of the Chloro, rose and hurried into the privy. There was the sound of retching. An uncomfortable silence fell while Stuart tried to think of something to say to cover the unpleasant sound. Mullen filled in. He had rummaged through a little box he had taken from under his pillow. He said,
"Perhaps Mr. LeBlanc had better take a sedative before retiring. I have a few. I'd be glad to give him one." He explained his generosity immediately. "Otherwise, he may keep the rest of us awake, you see."
"Very logical," said Stuart dryly. "You'd better save one for Sir Lancelot here. Save half a dozen." He walked to where Polyorcetes still sprawled and knelt at his side. "Comfortable, baby?" Wyndham said.
deuced poor taste speaking like that, Stuart.
Well, if you're so concerned about him, why don't you and Porter hoist him onto his cot?
He helped them do so. Polyorcides' arms were trembling erratically now. From what Stuart knew of the chloro nerve weapons, the man should be in an agony of pins and needles about now. Stuart said,
And don't be too gentle with him either. The damned fool might have gotten us all killed, and for what?
He pushed Polyorcides' stiff carcass to one side and sat at the edge of the cot. He said,
Can you hear me, Polyorcides?
Polyorcades' eyes gleamed. An arm lifted abortively and fell back.
Okay, then, listen. Don't try anything like that again. The next time, it may be the finish for all of us. If you had been a chloro and he had been an earthman, we'd be dead now. So just get one thing through your skull. We're sorry about your brother, and it's a rotten shame, but it was his own fault.
Polyorcades tried to heave, and Stuart pushed him back.
No, you keep on listening, he said. Maybe this is the only time I'll get to talk to you when you have to listen. Your brother had no right leaving passengers' quarters. There was no place for him to go. He just got in the way of our own man. We don't even know for certain that it was a chloro gun that killed him. It might have been one of our own.
Oh, I say, Stuart, objected Wyndham.
Stuart whirled at him. Do you have proof it wasn't? Did you see the shot? Could you tell from what was left of the body whether it was chloro energy or earth energy?
Polyorcades found his voice, driving his unwilling tongue into a fuzzy verbal snarl.
Damned, stinking, greeny bastard!
Me? Said Stuart. I know what's going on in your mind, Polyorcades. You think that when the paralysis wears off, you'll ease your feelings by slamming me around. Well, if you do, it will probably be curtains for all of us.
He rose, put his back against the wall. For the moment, he was fighting all of them.
None of you know the chloros the way I do. The physical differences you see are not important. The differences in their temperament are. They don't understand our views on sex, for instance. To them, it's just a biological reflex like breathing. They attach no importance to it, but they do attach importance to social groupings. Remember, their evolutionary ancestors had lots in common with our insects. They always assume that any group of Earthmen they find together makes up a social unit. That means just about everything to them. I don't understand exactly what it means. No Earthman can. But the result is that they never break up a group, just as we don't separate a mother and her children if we can help it. One of the reasons they may be treating us with kid gloves right now is that they imagine we're all broken up over the fact that they killed one of us and they feel guilt about it. But this is what you'll have to remember. We're going to be interned together and kept together for duration. I don't like the thought. I wouldn't have picked any of you for co-internees, and I'm pretty sure none of you would have picked me, but there it is. The chloros could never understand that our being together on the ship is only accidental. That means we've got to get along somehow. That's not just goody-goody talk about birds in their little nest agreeing. What do you think would have happened if the chloros had come in earlier and found Polyorcades and myself trying to kill each other? You don't know? Well, what do you suppose you would think of a mother you caught trying to kill her children? That's it, then. They would have killed every one of us as a bunch of chloro-type perverts and monsters. Got that? How about you, Polyorcades? Have you got it? So let's call names if we have to, but let's keep our hands to ourselves. And now, if none of you mind, I'll massage my hands back into shape. These synthetic hands that I got from the chloros, and that one of my own kind tried to mangle again.
For Claude LeBlanc, the worst was over. He had been sick enough, sick with many things, but sick most of all over having ever left Earth. It had been a great thing to go to college off Earth. It had been an adventure and had taken him away from his mother. Somehow, he had been sneakingly glad to make that escape after the first month of frightened adjustment. And then, on the summer holidays, he had been no longer Claude, the shy-spoken scholar, but LeBlanc, space traveler. He had swaggered the fact for all it was worth. It made him feel such a man to talk of stars and jumps and the customs and environments of other worlds. It had given him courage with Margaret. She had loved him for the dangers he had undergone. Except that this had been the first one, really, and he had not done so well. He knew it, and was ashamed and wished he were like Stuart. He used the excuse of mealtime to approach. He said, "Mr. Stewart?" Stewart looked up and said shortly, "How do you feel?" LeBlanc felt himself blush. He blushed easily, and the effort not to blush only made it worse. He said, "Much better, thank you. We're eating. I thought I'd bring you your ration." Stewart took the offered can. It was standard space ration, thoroughly synthetic, concentrated, nourishing, and somehow unsatisfying. It heated automatically when the can was opened, but could be eaten cold if necessary. Though a combined fork-spoon utensil was enclosed, the ration was of a consistency that made the use of fingers practical and not particularly messy. Stewart said, "Did you hear my little speech?" "Yes, sir." "I want you to know you can count on me." "Well, good. Now go and eat." "May I eat here?" "Suit yourself." For a moment they ate in silence, and then LeBlanc burst out, "You are so sure of yourself, Mr. Stewart. It must be very wonderful to be like that." "Sure of myself? Thanks. But there's your self-assured one." LeBlanc followed the direction of the nod in surprise. "Mr. Mullen? That little man? Oh, no. You don't think he's self-assured?" LeBlanc shook his head. He looked at Stewart intently to see if he could detect humor in his expression. "That one is just cold. He has no emotion in him. He's like a little machine. I find him repulsive. You're different, Mr. Stewart. You have it all inside, but you control it. I would like to be like that." And as though attracted by the magnetism of the mention, even though unheard of his name, Mullen joined them. His can of ration was barely touched. It was still steaming gently as he squatted opposite them. His voice had its usual quality of furtively rustling underbrush.
"How long, Mr. Stewart, do you think the trip will take?"
"Can't say, Mullen. They'll undoubtedly be avoiding the usual trade routes, and they'll be making more jumps through hyperspace than usual to throw off possible pursuit. I wouldn't be surprised if it took as long as a week. Why do you ask?" "I presume you have a very practical and logical reason?"
"Why, yes, certainly."
He seemed quite shell-backed to sarcasm. He said, "It occurred to me that it might be wise to ration the rations, so to speak."
"We've got enough food and water for a month. I checked on that first thing."
"I see. In that case, I will finish the can."
He did, using the all-purpose utensil daintily and patting a handkerchief against his unstained lips from time to time. Polyorcetes struggled to his feet some 2 hours later. He swayed a bit, looking like the spirit of hangover. He did not try to come closer to Stewart, but spoke from where he stood. He said,
"You stinking greeny spy, you watch yourself."
"You heard what I said before, Polyorcetes."
"I heard. But I also heard what you said about Aristides." "I won't bother with you because you're a bag of nothing but noisy air. But wait, someday you'll blow your air in one face too many, and it will be let out of you."
"I'll wait," said Stewart.
Wyndham hobbled over, leaning heavily on his cane.
"Now, now," he called with a wheezing joviality that overlaid his sweating anxiety so thinly as to emphasize it. "We're all Earthmen, dash it. Got to remember that. Keep it as a glowing light of inspiration. Never let down before the blasted chloros. We've got to forget private feuds and remember only that we are Earthmen united against alien blighters."
Stewart's comment was unprintable. Porter was right behind Wyndham. He had been in a close conference with the shaven-headed colonel for an hour, and now he said with indignation,
"It doesn't help to be a wise guy, Stewart. You listen to the colonel. We've been doing some hard thinking about the situation."
He had washed some of the grease off his face, wet his hair, and slicked it back. It did not remove the little tick on his right cheek just at the point where his lips ended, or make his hangnail hands more attractive in appearance.
"All right, Colonel," said Stewart. "What's on your mind?"
Wyndham said,
"I'd prefer to have all the men together."
"Okay, call them."
LeBlanc hurried over. Mullen approached with greater deliberation. Stewart said,
"You want that fellow?"
He jerked his head at Polyorcetes.
"Why, yes, Mr. Polyorcetes, may we have you, old fella?"
"Ah, leave me alone."
"Go ahead," said Stewart. "Leave him alone. I don't want him."
No, no, said Wyndham. This is a matter for all Earthmen. Mr. Polyorcetes, we must have you.
Polyorcetes rolled off one side of his cot. I'm close enough. I can hear you.
Wyndham said to Stuart,
Would they, the Chloros, I mean, have this room wired?
No, said Stuart. Why should they?
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. They didn't know what happened when Polyorcetes jumped me. They just heard the thumping when it started rattling the ship.
Maybe they were trying to give us the impression the room wasn't wired.
Listen, Colonel, I've never known a Chloro to tell a deliberate lie.
Polyorcetes interrupted calmly. That lump of noise just loves the Chloros.
Wyndham said hastily,
Let's not begin that. Look, Stuart, Porter and I have been discussing matters, and we have decided that you know the Chloros well enough to think of some way of getting us back to Earth.
It happens that you're wrong. I can't think of any way.
Maybe there is some way we can take the ship back from the blasted green fellas, suggested Wyndham. Some weakness they may have. Dash it, you know what I mean.
Tell me, Colonel, what are you after, your own skin or Earth's welfare?
I resent that question. I'll have you know that while I'm as careful of my own life as anyone has a right to be, I'm thinking of Earth primarily, and I think that's true of all of us.
Damn right, said Porter instantly. LeBlanc looked anxious, Polyorcetes resentful, and Mullen had no expression at all. Good, said Stuart. Of course, I don't think we can take the ship. They're armed and we aren't, but there's this. You know why the Chloros took this ship intact? It's because they need ships. They may be better chemists than Earthmen are, but Earthmen are better astronautical engineers. We have bigger, better, and more ships. In fact, if our crew had had a proper respect for military axioms in the first place, they would have blown the ship up as soon as it looked as though the Chloros were going to board.
LeBlanc looked horrified.
And kill the passengers?
Why not? You heard what the good colonel said. Every one of us puts his own lousy little life after Earth's interests. What good are we to Earth alive right now? None at all. What harm will this ship do in Chloro hands? A hell of a lot, probably.
Just why, asked Mullen, did our men refuse to blow up the ship? They must have had a reason.
They did. It's the firmest tradition of Earth's military men that there must never be an unfavorable ratio of casualties. If we had blown ourselves up, 20 fighting men and 7 civilians of Earth would be dead, as compared with an enemy casualty total of 0. So what happens? We let them board, kill 28, I'm sure we killed at least that many, and let them have the ship.
Talk, 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 jeered Polyorcetes.
There's a moral to this, said Stuart. We can't take the ship away from the Chloros. We might be able to rush them, though, and keep them busy long enough to allow one of us enough time to short the engines.
What? Yelled Porter, and Wyndham shushed him in fright.
Short the engines, Stuart repeated. That would destroy the ship, of course, which is what we want to do, isn't it?
LeBlanc's lips were white.
I don't think that would work.
We can't be sure till we try, but what have we to lose by trying?
Our lives, damn it, cried Porter. You insane maniac, you're crazy.
If I'm a maniac, said Stuart, and insane to boot, then naturally I'm crazy. But just remember that if we lose our lives, which is overwhelmingly probable, we lose nothing of value to Earth, whereas if we destroy the ship, as we just barely might, we do Earth a lot of good. What patriot would hesitate? Who here would put himself ahead of his world?
He looked about in the silence. Surely not you, Colonel Wyndham.
Wyndham coughed tremendously. My dear man, that is not the question. There must be a way to save the ship for Earth without losing our lives, eh?
All right, you name it.
Let's all think about it. Now, there are only 2 of the Chloros aboard ship. If one of us could sneak up on them and...
How? The rest of the ship's all filled with chlorine. We'd have to wear a spacesuit. Gravity in that part of the ship is hopped up to chloro level, so whoever is Patsy in the deal would be clumping around, metal on metal, slow and heavy. Oh, he could sneak up on them, sure, like a skunk trying to sneak downwind.
Then we'll drop it all, Porter's voice shook. Listen, Wyndham, there's not going to be any destroying the ship. My life means plenty to me, and if any of you try anything like that, I'll call the Chloros, I mean it.
Well, said Stuart, there's hero number 1. LeBlanc said. I want to go back to Earth, but I...
Mullen interrupted. I don't think our chances of destroying the ship are good enough unless...
Heroes number 2 and 3, what about you, Polyarchides? You would have the chance of killing 2 Chloros.
I want to kill them with my bare hands, growled the farmer, his heavy fists writhing. On their planet, I will kill dozens.
That's a nice safe promise for now. What about you, Colonel? Don't you want to march to death and glory with me?
Your attitude is very cynical and unbecoming, Stuart. It's obvious that if the rest are unwilling, then your plan will fall through.
Unless I do it myself, huh?
You won't, do you hear? Said Porter instantly.
Damn right I won't, agreed Stuart. I don't claim to be a hero. I'm just an average patriot, perfectly willing to head for any planet they take me to and sit out the war.
Mullen said thoughtfully. Of course, there is a way we could surprise the Chloros.
The statement would have dropped flat except for Polyarchides. He pointed a black-nailed, stubby forefinger and laughed harshly.
Mr. Bookkeeper, he said, Mr. Bookkeeper is a big-shot talker like this damned greeny spy Stuart.
All right, Mr. Bookkeeper, go ahead. You make big speeches also. Let the words roll like an empty barrel.
He turned to Stuart and repeated venomously,
Empty barrel, cripple hand, empty barrel, no good for anything but talk.
Mullins' soft voice could make no headway until Polyarchides was through, but then he said, speaking directly to Stuart,
We might be able to reach them from outside. This room has a sea chute, I'm sure.
What's a sea chute? Asked LeBlanc.
Well, began Mullen, and then stopped at a loss.
Stuart said mockingly, It's a euphemism, my boy. Its full name is casualty chute. It doesn't get talked about, but the main rooms on any ship would have them. They're just little airlocks down which you slide a corpse. Burial at space. Always lots of sentiment and bowed heads, with the captain making a rolling speech of the type Polyarchides here wouldn't like.
LeBlanc's face twisted.
Use that? To leave the ship?
Why not? Superstitious? Go on, Mullen.
The little man had waited patiently, he said.
Once outside, one could re-enter the ship by the steam tubes. It can be done, with luck. And then you would be an unexpected visitor in the control room.
Stuart stared at him curiously. How do you figure this out? What do you know about steam tubes?
Mullen coughed. You mean because I'm in the paper box business? Well, he grew pink, waited a moment, then made a new start in a colorless, unemotional voice. My company, which manufactures fancy paper boxes and novelty containers, made a line of spaceship candy boxes for the juvenile trade some years ago. It was designed so that if a string were pulled, small pressure containers were punctured and jets of compressed air shot out through the mock steam tubes, sailing the box across the room and scattering candy as it went. The sales theory was that the youngsters would find it exciting to play with the ship and fun to scramble for the candy. Actually, it was a complete failure. The ship would break dishes and sometimes hit another child in the eye. Worse still, the children would not only scramble for the candy, but would fight over it. It was almost our worst failure. We lost thousands. Still, while the boxes were being designed, the entire office was extremely interested. It was like a game, very bad for efficiency and office morale. For a while, we all became steam tube experts. I read quite a few books on ship construction, on my own time, however, not the company's.
Stuart was intrigued. He said, You know, it's a video sort of idea, but it might work if we had a hero to spare, have we?
What about you?
Demanded Porter indignantly.
You go around sneering at us with your cheap wisecracks. I don't notice you volunteering for anything.
That's because I'm no hero, Porter, I admit it. My object is to stay alive, and shinnying down steam tubes is no way to go about staying alive. But the rest of you are noble patriots. The colonel says so. What about you, Colonel? You're the senior hero here.
Wyndham said, "If I were younger, blast it, and if you had your hands, I would take pleasure, sir, in trouncing you soundly."
"I've no doubt of it, but that's no answer."
"You know very well that at my time of life and with my leg," he brought the flat of his hand down upon his stiff knee, "I am in no position to do anything of the sort, however much I should wish to."
"Ah, yes," said Stuart, "and I myself am crippled in the hands, as Polyorcides tells me. That saves us. And what unfortunate deformities do the rest of us have?"
"Listen," cried Porter, "I want to know what this is all about. How can anyone go down the steam tubes? What if the chloros use them while one of us is inside?"
"Why, Porter, that's part of the sporting chance. It's where the excitement comes in."
"But he'd be boiled in the shell like a lobster."
"A pretty image, but inaccurate. The steam wouldn't be on for more than a very short time, maybe a second or two, and the suit insulation would hold that long. Besides, the jet comes scooting out at several hundred miles a minute, so that you would be blown clear of the ship before the steam could even warm you. In fact, you'd be blown quite a few miles out into space, and after that you would be quite safe from the chloros. Of course, you couldn't get back to the ship."
Porter was sweating freely.
"You don't scare me for 1 minute, Stuart."
"I don't?"
"Then you're offering to go? Are you sure you've thought out what being stranded in space means? You're all alone, you know, really all alone. The steam jet will probably leave you turning or tumbling pretty rapidly. You won't feel that. You'll seem to be motionless, but all the stars will be going around and around so that they're just streaks in the sky. They won't ever stop. They won't even slow up. Then your heater will go off, your oxygen will give out, and you will die very slowly. You'll have lots of time to think, or if you were in a hurry, you could open your suit. That wouldn't be pleasant either. I've seen faces of men who had a torn suit happen to them accidentally, and it's pretty awful. But it would be quicker. Then..." Porter turned and walked unsteadily away. Stuart said lightly, "Another failure. One act of heroism, still ready to be knocked down to the highest bidder with nothing offered yet."
Polyorcides spoke up, and his harsh voice roughed the words. "You keep on talking, Mr. Big Mouth. You just keep banging that empty barrel. Pretty soon we'll kick your teeth in. There's one boy I think would be willing to do it now, eh, Mr. Porter?"
Porter's look at Stuart confirmed the truth of Polyorcides' remarks, but he said nothing. Stuart said, "Then what about you, Polyorcides? You're the bare-hand man with guts. Want me to help you into a suit?"
"I'll ask you when I want help."
"What about you, LeBlanc?" The young man shrank away.
"Not even to get back to Margaret?"
But LeBlanc could only shake his head. "Mullen?"
"Well, I'll try."
"You'll what?"
"I said, yes, I'll try. After all, it's my idea."
Stuart looked stunned. "You serious? How come?"
Mullen's prim mouth pursed. "Because no one else will."
"But that's no reason, especially for you," Mullen shrugged.
There was a thump of a cane behind Stuart. Wyndham brushed past. He said, "Do you really intend to go, Mullen?"
"Yes, Colonel."
"In that case, dash it. Let me shake your hand. I like you. You're an Earthman, by heaven. Do this, and win or die, I'll bear witness for you."
Mullen withdrew his hand awkwardly from the deep and vibrating grasp of the other. And Stuart just stood there. He was in a very unusual position. He was, in fact, in the particular position of all positions in which he most rarely found himself. He had nothing to say.
The quality of tension had changed. The gloom and frustration had lifted a bit, and the excitement of conspiracy had replaced it. Even Polyorcides was fingering the spacesuits and commenting briefly and hoarsely on which he considered preferable.
Mullen was having a certain amount of trouble. The suit hung rather limply upon him, even though the adjustable joints had been tightened nearly to minimum. He stood there now with only the helmet to be screwed on. He wiggled his neck. Stuart was holding the helmet with an effort. It was heavy, and his artoplasmic hands did not grip it well. He said, "Better scratch your nose if it itches. It's your last chance for a while." He didn't add maybe forever, but he thought it.
Mullen said tonelessly, I think perhaps I had better have a spare oxygen cylinder.
Good enough.
With a reducing valve.
Stuart nodded. I see what you're thinking of. If you do get blown clear of the ship, you could try to blow yourself back by using the cylinder as an action-reaction motor.
They clamped on the headpiece and buckled the spare cylinder to Mullen's waist. Polyorchides and LeBlanc lifted him up to the yawning opening of the C-tube. It was ominously dark inside, the metal lining of the interior having been painted a mournful black. Stuart thought he could detect a musty odor about it, but that, he knew, was only imagination. He stopped the proceedings when Mullen was half within the tube. He tapped upon the little man's faceplate.
"Can you hear me?"
Within there was a nod.
"Air coming through all right? No last-minute troubles?"
Mullen lifted his armored arm in a gesture of reassurance.
"And then remember, don't use the suit radio out there. The Chloros might pick up the signals."
Reluctantly, he stepped away. Polyorchides' brawny hands lowered Mullen until they could hear the thumping sound made by the steel-shod feet against the outer valve. The inner valve then swung shut with a dreadful finality, its beveled silicone gasket making a slight soughing noise as it crushed hard. They clamped it into place.
Stuart stood at the toggle switch that controlled the outer valve. He threw it, and the gauge that marked the air pressure within the tube fell to zero.
A little pinpoint of red light warned that the outer valve was open. Then the light disappeared, the valve closed, and the gauge climbed slowly to 15 pounds again. They opened the inner valve again and found the tube empty. Polyorchides spoke first. He said,
"The little son of a gun. He went."
He looked wonderingly at the others.
"A little fellow with guts like that."
Stuart said, "Look, we'd better get ready in here. There's just a chance that the Chloros may have detected the valves opening and closing. If so, they'll be here to investigate, and we'll have to cover up."
"How?"
asked Wyndham.
"They won't see Mullen anywhere around. We'll say he's in the head. The Chloros know that it's one of the peculiar characteristics of Earthmen that they resent intrusion on their privacy in lavatories, and they'll make no effort to check. If we can hold them off..."
"What if they wait? Or if they check the spacesuits?" asked Porter.
Stuart shrugged.
"Let's hope they don't. And listen, Polyorchides, don't make any fuss when they come in."
Polyorchides grunted.
"With that little guy out there, what do you think I am?"
He stared at Stuart without animosity, then scratched his curly hair vigorously.
"You know, I laughed at him. I thought he was an old woman. It makes me ashamed."
Stuart cleared his throat. He said, "Look, I've been saying some things that maybe weren't too funny after all, now that I come to think of it. I'd like to say I'm sorry if I have." He turned away morosely and walked toward his cot. He heard the steps behind him, felt the touch on his sleeve. He turned. It was LeBlanc. The youngster said softly,
"I keep thinking that Mr. Mullen is an old man."
"Well, he's not a kid. He's about 45 or 50, I think." LeBlanc said,
"Do you think, Mr. Stuart, that I should have gone instead? I'm the youngest here. I don't like the thought of having let an old man go in my place. It makes me feel like the devil."
"I know. If he dies, it will be too bad."
"But he volunteered. We didn't make him, did we?"
"Don't try to dodge responsibility, LeBlanc. It won't make you feel better. There isn't one of us without a stronger motive to run the risk than he had." And Stuart sat there silent with thinking.
Mullen felt the obstruction beneath his feet yield and the walls about him slip away quickly, too quickly. He knew it was the puff of air escaping, carrying him with it, and he dug arms and legs frantically against the wall to break himself. Corpses were supposed to be flung well clear of the ship, but he was no corpse, for the moment. His feet swung free and threshed. He heard the clunk of one magnetic boot against the hull, just as the rest of his body puffed out like a tight cork under air pressure. He teetered dangerously at the lip of the hole in the ship. He had changed orientation suddenly and was looking down on it, then took a step backward as its lid came down of itself and fitted smoothly against the hull. A feeling of unreality overwhelmed him. Surely it wasn't he standing on the outer surface of a ship. Not Randolph F. Mullen. so few human beings could ever say they had, even those who traveled in space constantly. He was only gradually aware that he was in pain. Popping out of that hole with one foot clamped to the hull had nearly bent him in two. He tried moving cautiously, and found his motions to be erratic and almost impossible to control. He thought nothing was broken, though the muscles of his left side were badly wrenched. And then he came to himself and noticed that the wrist lights of his suit were on. It was by their light that he had stared into the blackness of the sea chute. He stirred with the nervous thought that from within, the Chloros might see the twin spots of moving light just outside the hull. He flicked the switch upon the suit's midsection. Mullen had never imagined that, standing on a ship, he would fail to see its hull, but it was dark. As dark below as above. And there were the stars, hard and bright little non-dimensional dots. Nothing more anywhere. Under his feet, not even the stars, not even his feet. He bent back to look at the stars. His head swam. They were moving slowly, or rather, they were standing still, and the ship was rotating, but he could not tell his eyes that. They moved. His eyes followed down and behind the ship. New stars up and above from the other side, a black horizon. The ship existed only as a region where there were no stars. No stars? Why, there was one almost at his feet. He nearly reached for it. Then he realized that it was only a glittering reflection in the mirroring metal. They were moving thousands of miles an hour. The stars were, the ship was, he was, but it meant nothing. To his senses, there was only silence and darkness, and that slow wheeling of the stars. His eyes followed the wheeling, and his head in its helmet hit the ship's hull with a soft, bell-like ring. He felt about in panic with his thick, insensitive, spun silicate gloves. His feet were still firmly magnetized to the hull, that was true. But the rest of his body bent backward at the knees in a right angle. There was no gravity outside the ship. If he bent back, there was nothing to pull the upper part of his body down until his joints they were bending. His body stayed as he put it. He pressed wildly against the hull, and his torso shot upward and refused to stop when upright. He fell forward. He tried more slowly, balancing with both hands against the hull until he squatted evenly. Then upward. Very slowly, straight up, arms out to balance. He was straight now, aware of his nausea and lightheadedness. He looked about. My God, where were the steam tubes? He couldn't see them. They were black on black, nothing on nothing. Quickly, he turned on the wrist lights. In space, there were no beams, only elliptical, sharply defined spots of blue steel winking light back at him. Where they struck a rivet, a shadow was cast, knife-sharp, and as black as space. The lighted region illuminated abruptly and without diffusion. He moved his arms, his body swaying gently in the opposite direction, action and reaction. The vision of a steam tube with its smooth, cylindrical sides sprang at him. He tried to move toward it, his foot held firmly to the hull. He pulled, and it slogged upward, straining against quicksand that eased quickly. 3 inches up, and it had almost sucked free. 6 inches up, and he thought it would fly away. He advanced it and let it down, felt it enter the quicksand. When the sole was within 2 inches of the hull, it snapped down, out of control, hitting the hull ringingly. His spacesuit carried the vibrations, amplifying them in his ears. He stopped in absolute terror. The dehydrators that dried the atmosphere within his suit could not handle the sudden gush of perspiration that drenched his forehead and armpits. He waited, then tried lifting his foot again, a bare inch, holding it there by main force and moving it horizontally. Horizontal motion involved no effort at all. It was motion perpendicular to the lines of magnetic force. But he had to keep the foot from snapping down as he did so, and then lower it slowly. He puffed with the effort. Each step was agony. The tendons of his knees were cracking, and there were knives in his side. Mullen stopped to let the perspiration dry. It wouldn't do to steam up the inside of his faceplate. He flashed his wrist lights, and the steam cylinder was right ahead. The ship had four of them at 90-degree intervals. thrusting out at an angle from the mid-girdle. They were the fine adjustment of the ship's course. The course adjustment was the powerful thrusters back and front, which fixed final velocity by their accelerative and decelerative force. And the hyperatomics that took care of the space-swallowing jumps. But occasionally the direction of flight had to be adjusted slightly, and then the steam cylinders took over. Singly, they could drive the ship up, down, right, left. By twos, in appropriate ratios of thrust, the ship could be turned in any desired direction. The device had been unimproved in centuries, being too simple to improve. The atomic pile heated the water content of a closed container into steam, driving it, in less than a second, up to temperatures where it would have broken down into a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, and then into a mixture of electrons and ions. Perhaps the breakdown actually took place. No one ever bothered testing. It worked, so there was no need to. At the critical point, a needle valve gave way, and the steam thrust madly out in a short but incredible blast. And the ship, inevitably and majestically, moved in the opposite direction, veering about its own center of gravity. When the degrees of turn were sufficient, an equal and opposite blast would take place, and the turning would be canceled. The ship would be moving at its original velocity, but in a new direction. Mullen had dragged himself out to the lip of the steam cylinder. He had a picture of himself, a small speck teetering at the extreme end of a structure thrusting out of an ovoid that was tearing through space at 10,000 miles an hour. But there was no airstream to whip him off the hull, and his magnetic soles held him more firmly than he liked. With lights on, he bent down to peer into the tube, and the ship dropped down precipitously as his orientation changed. He reached out to steady himself, but he was not falling. There was no up or down in space except for what his confused mind chose to consider up or down. The cylinder was just large enough to hold a man so that it might be entered for repair purposes. His light caught the rungs almost directly opposite his position at the lip. He puffed a sigh of relief with what breath he could muster. Some ships didn't have ladders. He made his way to it, the ship appearing to slip and twist beneath him as he moved. He lifted an arm over the lip of the tube, feeling for the rung, loosened each foot, and drew himself within. The knot in his stomach that had been there from the first was a convulsed agony now. If they should choose to manipulate the ship, if the steam should whistle out now, he would never hear it, never know it. One instant he would be holding a rung, feeling slowly for the next with a groping arm. The next moment he would be alone in space, the ship a dark, dark nothingness lost forever among the stars. There would be perhaps a brief glory of swirling ice crystals drifting with him, shining in his wrist lights and slowly approaching and rotating about him, attracted by his mass like infinitesimal planets to an absurdly tiny sun. He was trickling sweat again, and now he was also conscious of thirst. He put it out of his mind. There would be no drinking until he was out of his suit, if ever. Up a rung, up another, and another. How many were there? His hand slipped, and he stared in disbelief at the glitter that showed under his light. Ice? Why not? The steam, incredibly hot as it was, would strike metal that was at nearly absolute zero. In the few split seconds of thrust, there would not be time for the metal to warm above the freezing point of water. A sheet of ice would condense that would sublime slowly into the vacuum. It was the speed of all that happened that prevented the fusion of the tubes and of the original water container itself. His groping hand reached the end. Again the wrist lights. He stared with crawling horror at the steam nozzle, half an inch in diameter. It looked dead, harmless. But it always would, right up to the microsecond before. Around it was the outer steam lock. It pivoted on a central hub that was springed on the portion toward space, screwed on the part toward the ship. The springs allowed it to give under the first wild thrust of steam pressure before the ship's mighty inertia could be overcome. The steam was bled into the inner chamber, breaking the force of the thrust, leaving the total energy unchanged, but spreading it over time so that the hull itself was in that much less danger of being staved in. Mullen braced himself firmly against a rung and pressed against the outer lock so that it gave a little. It was stiff, but it didn't have to give much, just enough to catch on the screw. He felt it catch. He strained against it and turned it, feeling his body twist in the opposite direction. It held tight, the screw taking up the strain as he carefully adjusted the small control switch that allowed the springs to fall free. How well he remembered the books he had read. He was in the interlock space now, which was large enough to hold a man comfortably, again for convenience in repairs. He could no longer be blown away from the ship. If the steam blast were turned on now, it would merely drive him against the interlock, hard enough to crush him to a pulp. A quick death he would never feel, at least. Slowly, he unhooked his spare oxygen cylinder. There was only an interlock between himself and the control room now. This lock opened outward into space so that the steam blast could only close it tighter rather than blow it open, and it fitted tightly and smoothly. There was absolutely no way to open it from without. He lifted himself above the lock, forcing his bent back against the inner surface of the interlock area. It made breathing difficult. The spare oxygen cylinder dangled at a queer angle. He held its metal mesh hose and straightened it, forcing it against the interlock so that vibration thudded. Again. Again. It would have to attract the attention of the Chloros. They would have to investigate. He would have no way of telling when they were about to do so. Ordinarily, they would first let air into the interlock to force the outer lock shut. But now the outer lock was on the central screw, well away from its rim. Air would suck about it ineffectually, dragging out into space. Mullen kept on thumping. Would the Chloros look at the air gauge, note that it scarcely lifted from zero, or would they take its proper working for granted? Porter said, "He's been gone an hour and a half." "I know," said Stewart. They were all restless, jumpy, but the tension among themselves had disappeared. It was as though all the threads of emotion extended to the hull of the ship. Porter was bothered. His philosophy of life had always been simple. Take care of yourself, because no one will take care of you for you. It upset him to see it shaken. He said, "Do you suppose they've caught him?" "If they had, we'd hear about it," replied Stewart briefly. Porter felt, with a miserable twinge, that there was little interest on the part of the others in speaking to him. He could understand it. He had not exactly earned their respect. For the moment, a torrent of self-excuse poured through his mind. The others had been frightened, too. A man had a right to be afraid. No one likes to die. At least he hadn't broken like Aristides Polyarchides. He hadn't wept like LeBlanc. But there was Mullen out there on the hull. "Listen," he cried. "Why did he do it?" They turned to look at him, not understanding, but Porter didn't care. It bothered him to the point where it had to come out. "I want to know why Mullen is risking his life." "The man," said Wyndham, "is a patriot." "No, none of that." Porter was almost hysterical. "That little fellow has no emotions at all. He just has reasons. And I want to know what those reasons are, because..." He didn't finish the sentence. Could he say that if those reasons applied to a little middle-aged bookkeeper, they might apply even more forcibly to himself? Polyarchides said, "He's one brave, damn little fellow." Porter got to his feet. "Listen," he said, "he may be stuck out there. Whatever he's doing, he may not be able to finish it alone. I volunteer to go out after him." He was shaking as he said it, and he waited in fear for the sarcastic lash of Stewart's tongue. Stewart was staring at him, probably with surprise, but Porter dared not meet his eyes to make certain. Stewart said mildly, "Let's give him another half hour." Porter looked up, startled. There was no sneer on Stewart's face. It was even friendly. They all looked friendly. He said, "And then?" "And then all those who do volunteer will draw straws or something equally democratic. Who volunteers besides Porter?" They all raised their hands. Stewart did too. But Porter was happy. He had volunteered first. He was anxious for the half hour to pass. It caught Mullen by surprise. The outer lock flew open, and the long, thin, snake-like, almost headless neck of a Chloro sucked out, unable to fight the blast of escaping air. Mullen's cylinder flew away, almost tore free. After one wild moment of frozen panic, he fought for it, dragging it above the airstream, waiting as long as he dared to let the first fury die down as the air of the control room thinned out, then bringing it down with force. It caught the sinewy neck squarely, crushing it. Mullen curled above the lock, almost entirely protected from the stream, raised the cylinder again, and plunging it down again,
striking the head, mashing the staring eyes to liquid ruin. In the near vacuum, green blood was pumping out of what was left of the neck. Mullen dared not vomit, but he wanted to. With eyes averted, he backed away, caught the outer lock with one hand, and imparted a whirl. For several seconds, it maintained that whirl. At the end of the screw, the springs engaged automatically and pulled it shut. What was left of the atmosphere tightened it, and the laboring pumps could now begin to fill the control room once again. Mullen crawled over the mangled chloro and into the room. It was empty. He had barely time to notice that when he found himself on his knees, he rose with difficulty. The transition from non-gravity to gravity had taken him entirely by surprise. It was chlorine gravity, too, which meant that with this suit, he carried a 50% overload for his small frame. At least, though, his heavy metal clogs no longer clung so exasperatingly to the metal underneath. Within the ship, floors and wall were of cork-covered aluminum alloy. He circled slowly. The necklace chloro had collapsed and lay with only an occasional twitch to show it had once been a living organism. He stepped over it distastefully and drew the steam tube lock shut. The room had a depressing bilious cast, and the lights shone yellow-green. It was the chloro atmosphere, of course. Mullen felt a twinge of surprise and reluctant admiration. The chloros obviously had some way of treating materials so that they were impervious to the oxidizing effect of chlorine. Even the map of Earth on the wall, printed on glossy plastic-backed paper, seemed fresh and untouched. He approached, drawn by the familiar outlines of the continents. There was a flash of motion caught in the corner of his eyes. As quickly as he could in his heavy suit, he turned, then screamed. The chloro he had thought dead was rising to its feet. Its neck hung limp, an oozing mass of tissue mash, but its arms reached out blindly, and the tentacles about its chest vibrated rapidly like innumerable snakes' tongues. It was blind, of course. The destruction of its neck stalk had deprived it of all sensory equipment, and partial asphyxiation had disorganized it, but the brain remained whole and safe in the abdomen. It still lived. Mullen backed away. He circled, trying clumsily and unsuccessfully to tiptoe, though he knew that what was left of the chloro was also death. It blundered on its way, struck a wall, felt to the base, and began sidling along it. Mullen cast about desperately for a weapon, found nothing. There was the chloro's holster, but he dared not reach for it. Why hadn't he snatched it at the very first, fool? The door to the control room opened. It made almost no noise. Mullen turned, quivering. The other chloro entered, unharmed and tired. It stood in the doorway for a moment, chest tendrils stiff and unmoving, its neck stalk stretched forward, its horrible eyes flickering first at him and then at its nearly dead comrade, and then its hand moved quickly to its side. Mullen, without awareness, moved as quickly in pure reflex. He stretched out the hose of the spare oxygen cylinder, which, since entering the control room, he had replaced in its suit clamp, and cracked the valve. He didn't bother reducing the pressure. He let it gush out unchecked so that he nearly staggered under the backward push. He could see the oxygen stream. It was a pale puff billowing out amid the chlorine green. It caught the chloro with one hand on the weapon's holster. The chloro threw its hands up. The little beak on its head nodule opened alarmingly but noiselessly. It staggered and fell, writhed for a moment, then lay still. Mullen approached and played the oxygen stream upon its body as though he were extinguishing a fire. And then he raised his heavy foot and brought it down upon the center of the neck stalk and crushed it on the floor. He turned to the first. It was sprawled, rigid. The whole room was pale with oxygen, enough to kill whole legions of chloros, and his cylinder was empty. Mullen stepped over the dead chloro out of the control room and along the main corridor toward the prisoner's room. Reaction had set in. He was whimpering in blind, incoherent fright. Stuart was tired, false hands and all. He was at the controls of a ship once again. Two light cruisers of Earth were on the way. For better than 24 hours, he had handled the controls virtually alone. He had discarded the chlorinating equipment, re-rigged the old atmospherics, located the ship's position in space, tried to plot a course, and sent out carefully guarded signals which had worked. So when the door of the control room opened, he was a little annoyed. He was too tired to play conversational handball. Then he turned, and it was Mullen stepping inside. Stewart said,
"For God's sake, get back into bed, Mullen,"
Mullen said. "I'm tired of sleeping, even though I never thought I would be a while ago."
"How do you feel?"
"I'm stiff all over, especially my side." He grimaced and stared involuntarily around.
"Don't look for the chloro," Stuart said. "We dumped the poor devils."
He shook his head.
"I was sorry for them. To themselves, they're the human beings, you know. And we're the aliens. Not that I'd rather they'd killed you understand?"
"I understand."
Stuart turned a sidelong glance upon the little man who sat looking at the map of Earth and went on, "I owe you a particular and personal apology, Mullen. I didn't think much of you."
"It was your privilege," said Mullen in his dry voice. There was no feeling in it.
"No, it wasn't. It is no one's privilege to despise another. It is only a hard-won right after long experience."
"Have you been thinking about this?"
"Yes, all day. Maybe I can't explain. It's these hands."
He held them up before him, spread out.
"It was hard, knowing that other people had hands of their own. I had to hate them for it. I always had to do my best to investigate and belittle their motives, point up their deficiencies, expose their stupidities. I had to do anything that would prove to myself that they weren't worth envying."
Mullen moved restlessly.
"This explanation is not necessary." "It is, it is."
Stuart felt his thoughts intently, strained to put them into words.
"For years I've abandoned hope of finding any decency in human beings. Then you climbed into the sea chute."
"You had better understand," said Mullen, "that I was motivated by practical and selfish considerations. I will not have you present me to myself as a hero."
"I wasn't intending to. I know that you would do nothing without a reason. It was what your action did to the rest of us. It turned a collection of phonies and fools into decent people, and not by magic either. They were decent all along. It was just that they needed something to live up to, and you supplied it. And I'm one of them. I'll have to live up to you, too, for the rest of my life, probably."
Mullen turned away uncomfortably. His hand straightened his sleeves, which were not in the least twisted. His finger rested on the map. He said, "I was born in Richmond, Virginia, you know. Here it is. I'll be going there first. Where were you born?"
"Toronto," said Stuart.
"That's right here. Not very far apart on the map, is it?"
Stuart said, "Would you tell me something?"
"If I can."
"Just why did you go out there?"
Mullen's precise mouth pursed. He said dryly, "Wouldn't my rather prosaic reason ruin the inspirational effect?"
"Call it intellectual curiosity. Each of the rest of us had such obvious motives. Porter was scared to death of being interned. LeBlanc wanted to get back to his sweetheart. Polyorcetes wanted to kill Chloros. And Wyndham was a patriot, according to his lights. As for me, I thought of myself as a noble idealist, I'm afraid. Yet in none of us was the motivation strong enough to get us into a spacesuit and out the sea chute. Then what made you do it, you of all people?"
"Why the phrase, of all people?
Don't be offended. But you seem devoid of all emotion."
"Do I?" Mullen's voice did not change. It remained precise and soft, yet somehow a tightness had entered it. "That's only training, Mr. Stuart, and self-discipline, not nature. A small man can have no respectable emotions. Is there anything more ridiculous than a man like myself in a state of rage? I'm 5 feet and 1/2 inch tall, and 102 pounds in weight, if you care for exact figures. I insist on the 1/2 inch and the 2 pounds. Can I be dignified, proud, draw myself to my full height without inducing laughter? Where can I meet a woman who will not dismiss me instantly with a giggle? Naturally, I've had to learn to dispense with external display of emotion. You talk about deformities. No one would notice your hands or know they were different if you weren't so eager to tell people all about it the instant you meet them. Do you think that the 8 inches of height I do not have can be hidden?
that it is not the first, and in most cases, the only thing about me that a person will notice? Stuart was ashamed. He had invaded a privacy he ought not have. He said, I'm sorry. Why? I should not have forced you to speak of this. I should have seen for myself that you... That I what? Tried to prove myself, tried to show that while I might be small in body, I held within it a giant's heart. I would not have put it mockingly. Why not? It's a foolish idea, and nothing like it is the reason I did what I did. What would I have accomplished if that's what was in my mind? Will they take me to Earth now and put me up before the television cameras, pitching them low, of course, to catch my face, or standing me on a chair and pin medals on me? They're quite likely to do exactly that, and what good would it do me? They would say, gee, and he's such a little guy. And afterward what? Shall I tell each man I meet, you know, I'm the fellow they decorated for incredible valor last month? How many medals, Mr. Stewart, do you suppose it would take to put 8 inches and 60 pounds on me? Stewart said, put that way, I see your point. Mullen was speaking a trifle more quickly now. A controlled heat had entered his words, warming them to just a tepid room temperature. There were days when I thought I would show them the mysterious them that includes all the world. I was going to leave Earth and carve out worlds for myself. I would be a new and even smaller Napoleon. So I left Earth and went to Arcturus. And what could I do on Arcturus that I could not have done on Earth? Nothing. I balance books, so I am past the vanity, Mr. Stewart, of trying to stand on tiptoe. Then why did you do it? I left Earth when I was 28 and came to the Arcturian system. I've been there ever since. This trip was to be my first vacation, my first visit back to Earth in all that time. I was going to stay on Earth for 6 months. The Chloros instead captured us and would have kept us interned indefinitely. But I couldn't let them stop me from traveling to Earth. No matter what the risk, I had to prevent their interference. It wasn't love of woman or fear or hate or idealism of any sort. It was stronger than any of those. He stopped and stretched out a hand as though to caress the map on the wall. Mr. Stewart, Mullen asked quietly, haven't you ever been homesick?